Hello, welcome to Growing Wild. I am Charlotte Petz. This show is sponsored by Infinity Foods and you are listening to Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM, online and on digital. On this month's show, we are talking about land access. Campaigner, author, all-round wonder, Marion Shaud, talks to us about our right to roam. Chris Smith from the Outdoor Spaces Society talks to us about why it's important to keep our public rights of way. And the filmmakers Asa Mark and Hilary Bain tell us about their project, The Worm is Turning. But first of all, as ever, we have a song, and it's Up on the Roof by The Drifters.
Up on the roof. When this old world starts getting me down, and people are just too much for me to face, I climb way up to the top of the stairs, and all my cares just drift right into space.
That is Up on the Roof by The Drifters. I'm obsessed with that song. I am listening to that over and over and over. Okay, so regular listeners to this show may have picked up on the fact that I have a general puzzlement about how humans can really own land. I think the land is our earth and we're kind of residents on it, and we have a duty of stewardship for other beings and for our future generations. And luckily there's others among us who still feel this way, and Marion Shaud, who is my first guest, is very much one of those. She's a campaigner, she's an author of books such as This Land Is Our Land, A Right to Roam, and many others, and she was a strong campaigner in aiding the enactment of the Countryside Rights of Way Act in 2000. I spoke to her earlier in the week and I started out by asking her what exactly is our right to roam.
There are two types of rights of access to the countryside which came in after the year, well, on or after the year 2000. Now, one applies up north of the border in Scotland, and that was enacted through the Land Reform Scotland Act of 2003. And that gives people essentially a right to move around in the countryside and also engage in other activities. So if there's a body of water, they've got a right to take a non-motorised craft on it, like a yacht or a rowing boat or a raft, that kind of thing. Mm. So quite a wide right of access up there. It's different in England and Wales. Under our Countryside and Rights of Way Act of 2000, we have a right to move freely, but on foot only, over certain types of land. The types of land are land that is over 600 metres high, and that's called mountain, and also moor, heath and down, and also something called registered common land. The thing is that whereas in Scotland it's sort of universal right, and then certain categories of land like sort of bowling greens and golf greens and so on are exempted, in England and Wales the thing is that sort of law of trespass remains in place everywhere, but over certain types of land there is this more general legal right to roam freely. But it tends to benefit the uplands rather than the lowlands. Mm. And is it's a valuable step, but it's limited. And I've always argued, or at least since 1987, that there should be a general right of access on foot, at least throughout the United Kingdom. But there would be provision for restrictions to make sure that damage was not caused, and for instance, to nesting birds or to important agricultural operations. Yeah.
Why is it different? Because am I right in thinking that in Scotland it used to be a lot worse? It was really in lockdown, wasn't it? It was quite...
Yes, it was.
Yeah,
yes.
Very strict. Yes. And now they've gone to such a level of freedom. Do you know why there's such a discrepancy between England and Scotland?
Well, you're right. I mean, if you went to the Highlands of Scotland in sort of Victorian times, there were vast areas that people just couldn't set foot on, and they were given over to deer stalking and also grouse shooting. And this was a terrible scandal, and so there was a lot of public protest about all that. And what happened in the sort of 20th century, particularly late 20th century, was that gradually you got a sort of freedom to walk, or to walk in Scotland's hills, that was tolerated. I mean, in Scotland, land has always been thought to be a very important issue, to some extent the property of the nation as a whole, even if they don't, you know, necessarily all own legal title to it. Whereas in England and Wales, there was a lot of sort of lobbying, as indeed there was in Scotland, but somehow there wasn't quite the move, the political pressure to have a general right of access, and the Blair government ended up with this quite restricted right. So the debate in the South was cast in terms of, well, you know, if you're on Dartmoor, say, it's wrong if you're walking along a public right of way, not to be able to wander off and go up onto a crag or a tor or something if there's no right of way to it. Mm. And so you've got to have this general right to just wander off. But it was very much for these wild mountain and moorland areas. Whereas my stance has always been, I think, a general right of access to the countryside should be a sort of citizen's right, a right to move freely around your native land. It seems to me it should be a general sort of human right in Britain. Do you see?
Yeah. So questioning the notion of land ownership as a whole, really, isn't it? I mean, how can a human own the land? It seems almost
that's right.
a preposterous
yes.
notion. Yeah.
That's it does. And yeah. that idea that land is actually different from other chattels that people can say they own is an idea that goes back long into history. You know, the diggers of the time of the time of Oliver Cromwell, they were going out and saying, you know, they were casting it very much in terms of religion, but the land is the Lord's. You know, that the thing is that God created all this land, and you can't have human beings just saying that they own it. It's a resource for everybody, and certainly the idea of some people just, you know, appropriating a great number of rights over land that they say they own, including the right to exclude their fellow citizens from setting foot on it, seems to be outrageous to many people, and to me included.
It's just fear. People have fear of what other people might do to something, and often it's unfounded.
So you've got to have safeguards in place that if there are serious problems, then there's machinery for dealing with them. Mm. It's just got to be done very carefully. You know, it's not an easy thing to just do overnight, but I think it should be done, and particularly for lowland Britain, where actually most of the population live, and where you still have, you know, lots of lovely areas which are out of bounds to people. You know, woodlands is another category of landscape feature. I mean, you'd think you could have a right to walk in your woods, wouldn't you, for goodness sakes? Mm. But it's not the case. I mean, the Forestry Commission, the State Forestry Commission, allows general public access to their woodland, but they own, I think it's only 13% of the woodland area of England, which is a significant amount, but it's not, obviously not everywhere. An organisation called Woods for People did some calculations in 2009, and they found that more than 60% of the total woodland area was out of bounds to walkers. So that's an awful lot.
Yeah, that's a huge amount.
And it's an awful lot. People don't really often realise that.
Okay. As humans, we are creatures of... we take the path of least resistance. So even when these areas are opened out, is it that we just sort of stray up the path that we can see anyway? I mean, does it actually make that much difference?
I think it does. I think people do ramble freely over these areas. But you're right, there is a tendency on the part of people to keep to paths.
Mm.
So
we've always got to unlearn that for ourselves, haven't we, and be a bit braver.
We have. Yes, that's right. I mean, I find you get so much more out of going in the countryside if you just wander around wherever the mood takes you, really.
Yeah.
But there's also, I guess, a tradition, a sort of fashion at the moment for moving very fast through the countryside on marathon walks and that kind of thing, and jogging. So the countryside is used as a place to kind of keep fit at the moment. So those kind of people will tend to keep to paths, of course. But if you're just out to enjoy the open air and seek spiritual refreshment and go bird watching and, you know, look at flowers or whatever, then it's very good to wander around freely.
So what can we do? Is it something that we need to keep pressure up on the government and to open out even more space, you know, like the lowland areas you're talking about, the woodland? Is there anything that we can do to help with that?
Well, I think we can. We can campaign, we can write to our MPs, we can keep the pressure up.
What are your thoughts on landowners that try and redirect footpaths, you know, public rights of way that they might deem to be going across their land, and they want it to be further away from their property, or if they've designated it as an area they'd like to develop, or, you know, ring fenced it?
You know, it depends. I mean, sometimes it's okay to redirect a right of way, but you've got to make sure that the new route is just as good for the walkers as the old route. You know, you can't just turn up and buy a bit of land and say, this is inconvenient having these rights of way across my land, I want to extinguish them all or divert them all. And indeed, the law does provide for quite good safeguards to ensure that that doesn't happen. So if you've got a right of way on your land, you mustn't obstruct it, so you mustn't just put a barbed wire fence across it. You've got to keep it open so people can use it. And legal action can be taken against you if you do obstruct it. Also, you can't extinguish it. But if you want to divert it, you have to apply to your highway authority for permission to do so. And they're not going to allow you to do so if the route that would result as a result of the diversion is less convenient to the public or less enjoyable for them.
In all of your years of campaigning, what has been for you the most sort of heartening change that you've seen over the years? Or the most significant?
I think what was significant was probably way back in 1980, I brought out my first book called The Theft of the Countryside, and it was about the ways in which modern farming was changing the countryside, particularly of England, with the removal of hedgerows and woods and drainage of wetlands and ponds and so on. And up till then, the general public hadn't twigged that this was all happening. And I had been working in the conservation movement for about 4 years, and I thought, this is the biggest threat to the beauty and variety and wildlife diversity of our countryside. And I wrote this book, and it did have a big impact. And I won't say it necessarily resulted in the saving of particular landscape features, although I hope it did. But it did prompt a big public debate and change the public consciousness, I think. I
mean, raised awareness.
It raised awareness. Yeah. And the Times published a review of my book, and it sparked off a correspondence of 30 letters in the Times. And it was terribly interesting correspondence, because it was from people travelling around on trains, looking out the window, thinking, oh, yes, actually, this is happening out there. And then it went through, you know, a debate about, well, does that matter? And do we need to grow all the food? Must that overrule any concern about conservation? And what should we do about this in the future? And so it did spark off that debate, I think. And it's still going on. So I think that had quite a big impact.
I think you're brilliant. I think you've done such great things.
Thank you for all of the work that you've done.
Slightly fangirled her at the end there, but I do think that she's brilliant and she has done such great work. And it's people like that that really do make a change. You know, they see something going on and they think, no, that's not good enough, and they work really hard to get it changed. I would encourage you to read her work. I will put the links to her website up on the show page on the Growing Wild show page on RadioReverb.com. At the end there, she talked about how modern farming has come along and questioning whether growing food should overrule conservation. That's something I'm going to come back to in the last segment with Asa and Hillary, who've made a film called The Worm is Turning, and they question those things as well. So that's later on in the show. So let's have a song, and it's This Land is Our Land by Woody Guthrie, and we're going to come back and hear from Chris Smith of the Outdoor Spaces Society.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
That was Woody Guthrie, and This Land is Your Land. Okay, so next up, Chris Smith of the Outdoor Spaces Society. Now, he got in touch with us here at the station about a situation up on the Old Lewis Racecourse where a landowner up there is looking to move a public bridleway so it runs further away from his house. Chris, on behalf of the Outdoor Spaces Society, is objecting to this, and I went to have a chat with him about the situation up there, and I started by asking him, what is the Open Spaces Society?
The Open Spaces Society is the oldest organisation protecting the rights of individuals to go out and enjoy themselves in open spaces. It is formerly the Commons Footpath and Open Spaces Society, and was founded in the early part of the 19th century. In the 1930s, 1940s, the OSS was a bit conservative, and it was kind of overtaken by the Ramblers Association, which came out of the 1930s mass movement of people who began to have some leisure time. And it was really eclipsed by the Ramblers. But in recent years, under our General Secretary, Kate Ashbrook, we've become something like the provisional version of the Ramblers. Right. That, you know, the OSS members are a small group, but perhaps more aggressive or assertive, I think is the word I would use.
Okay. So tell me about this situation that's happening. Where is it in Lewis and what's happening up there?
Okay. Lewis Racecourse has been around for a very long time. So it's a remote place, and it's a very popular area of resort for people in Lewis and visitors who want to get up on the South Downs. The bridleway in question is the main way of getting, or one of the main ways of getting, from Lewis to the South Downs Way. So it's extremely popular. It's used by horse riders, it's used by cyclists, it's used by walkers. And the first we heard about anything was last year, when there was a proposal to develop the right, to move the right of way, so that it was quite a long way, about 100 metres from the racecourse. It was a very awkward diversion, and it meant that people couldn't see the remains of the racecourse, which is part of our heritage. Now, at the same time, various owners asked Lewis Town Council to zone that area, the area which would have been, which the current bridleway covers, for housing. And of course, if you can get a piece of land zoned for housing, you make a huge amount of money. Mm. Now, that application was rejected, and indeed the application to zone the place for housing was rejected, but only because it was outside of the Lewis Town Council area. Mm. So plainly, the landowners have ambitions to develop the site. If not now, then in the future. The landowner has, without planning permission, built the replacement bridleway. Now, it's a quite hideous structure. It's a nearly tarmacked road, about 4 metres wide, accompanied by a large amount of very visually obvious wooden fencing and some gates. And he has also tried to do everything to discourage people from using the legal route of the bridleway, short of actually obstructing it or actually making it impossible to use. Mm-hmm. For example, he has almost entirely fenced off the southern end of the route that he wants to change, but left a little 5-foot gap. And he has arranged things so that the path leads obviously onto his preferred diversion and not onto the bridleway, although the bridleway has been signposted by the Rights of Way team. Well, this has been going on now since about October last year.
Okay.
But it is now hotting up.
Right.
The Open Spaces Society has been very critical of the planning department because these fences and this road that I've told you about require planning permission. And no planning permission has been applied for. It is quite a major change in the landscape, and the planning department confirmed that it does in fact need planning permission, but they don't seem to know what to do about the fact that this person has gone ahead and done it all without getting any planning permission.
Is it fairly common, this sort of situation, where landowners will try their luck and try and divert walkers away from what is their right, you know?
As local authorities' budgets are cut, then it becomes more common. I would say that at any given time, there are perhaps 20 or 30 live issues in East Sussex alone. I must stress, the majority of landowners have come to terms with the fact that there are rights of way on their land, and some use those. For example, people want to build holiday cottages and they want their guests to be able to walk places. Farmers open livery stables where people can keep their horses, and those farmers obviously want the bridleways to be open, and sometimes you get a rather dramatic change in attitude. One farmer I had a lot of difficulty with in Arlington suddenly started ringing me up and saying, "Why is this bridleway blocked on my neighbour's land?" And the answer, reason for that was that he'd started taking in horses and letting people keep horses on his land.
So it's where money's involved, basically, isn't it?
Land is very valuable.
Yeah,
land is very valuable in the southeast, and land with planning permission is hugely valuable. So all kind of dodgy dealings go on. For example, in this case, the landowner tells me that he spent over £30,000 building this alternative bridleway. Now, you don't, in my view, do that unless you expect some return on your money.
Why is it important for us to not just use the new bridleway that he's created? Some people might say, well, we can still get up there. There's still a route. It may not be the one that legally it should be, but we can still walk along it. Why is it important for us to really stick to our guns and say, no, this is our right? You know, why is that important?
Because unless you defend rights of way, then they tend to disappear. Where alterations are made, they are almost never to the user's advantage. And indeed, in Sussex, if you look at each parish, then in parishes like Ringmer, where the parish council and the local walking group are very active, the rights of way are in very good condition. But if you go out to somewhere like Hellingley, where the parish council is dominated by landowners and there is no active person looking after rights of way, you can get lost hideously. I remember one walking group who said, "We went to Hellingley, we won't be going there again."
Right, wow. So that's what can we do then as a walker? What do we need to do to help situations like this?
You can do a number of things. Firstly, every time you come across a problem on a right of way, do report it to the local rights of way team. The second thing to do is to go out and have a walk on places you haven't been before. Let's use the whole of our rights of way system, because it's a heritage that is almost unique in a developed country, and we need to protect it. And thirdly, I'd encourage you to join either the Ramblers or the Open Spaces Society, or both, because those groups are working to protect rights away and all the other places that you and I walk or cycle or ride.
So that was Chris Smith of the Open Spaces Society. You can hear how important this situation is to him, and I can understand why as well. I did actually go up there to have a look around, and I made a little piece while I was up there. And as I was re-listening and beginning to edit it, I was just really acutely aware of how unbelievably biased I am. And I felt like it was important to hear the other side, the side of the landowner, Mr. Fitch Hayes, and I wanted to know what his reasons were for wanting to divert this path. So I got in touch with him and had a chat. And his view on it is he has put in a legal application to divert the route, and that was back in 2014. It's not an ancient bridleway, but one from 1954. And the landowner then, Earl Schiffner, in his words, was too lazy to oppose it. It runs through three paddocks. It's commercial land where horses are both kept and trained. Mr. Fitch Hayes has had to clear up fly tipping. He's had incidents of indecent exposure, of lamping, of dirt bikes using the path. He believes that the terrain of the current path is unsafe for cyclists and horses. He has created this new path, which is further away from his house for those reasons and for what he believes is in the interests of safety for his family. And the new path that he has created is more wheelchair accessible, it's wider, it's easier for all of the users. He did apologise to the council for blocking the real bridleway for 48 hours, which he said he did whilst using pesticides on the land, and he didn't want any users of the path to be affected by that, namely dogs. If the Rights of Way team get back to him and reject his proposal, then he will put the land back to how it was and get rid of the path that he has made up there. But he believes that he has more than enough reasons for the diversion to be accepted. He made no reference about developing the site, which Chris mentioned. So those were the words of Mr. Fitch Hayes and his interpretation on the situation up there. So, you know, it is really interesting. In this particular case, the path isn't a massive diversion away, but for Chris, it's the principle of the matter and potentially wealthy people throwing their weight around a little bit and disregarding people's rights. And it's just that thing, if we do stop fighting, then these paths just do disappear. And in that vein, there's a situation where we have to get all of the rights of way marked out by 2026. It was a caveat that was put into the Countryside Rights of Way Act in 2000, which Marion was talking about. So it won't affect any of the current ones, but there's a lot that disappeared when plans were being made by whoever. There were quite a lot of rights of way that disappeared. So there's a lot of work being done by parish councils, by people like Chris, people like Marion, to go back a little bit further and see where these rights of way were, to find the paths that were there and to have them reinstated. And it all has to be done before 2026, otherwise they can never be reinstated. So for Chris, it's about the principle of the matter and for us to not have our rights eroded. And for John, Mr. Fitch Hayes, it's about him protecting his, what he sees as protecting his family and their future interests. Okay, let's have a song. It's going to be, well, it has to be really, Fleetwood Mac and You Can Go Your Own Way. You can go your own way. That was You Can Go Your Own Way by Fleetwood Mac. You're listening to Growing Wild on Radio Reverb, sponsored by Infinity Foods, and I'm Charlotte Petts. Okay, so next up we have Asa Mark and Hilary Bain. They have made a film called The Worm Is Turning. It picks up a little bit on what Marion was saying about her work in The Theft of the Countryside, about whether food production should interfere with conservation, but it goes a lot further than that. They were in Brighton for a screening of their film. Let's listen to the trailer. Let's have a little taster of the trailer so you can get a little idea of what the film's like.
Where did all this come from? Where did pesticides come from? Where did chemical fertilizers come from?
Most of the soil life on commercial farms in this country is dead.
If people really knew what's going on with the soil, what's going on with the plants, what's going on inside of our bodies, people would freak out. They'd be scared.
The trap is so intense that they are unable to come out of it.
By 1980, there will be over 4 billion. Food production must keep pace with this rapidly growing world population.
It's not about the more food, it's about power. The reason that a billion people are going hungry is not because of a shortage of food.
We've had a process now of roughly 100 years where we've shoved 98% of the population into big cities.
They really were pushed away from the farms without any prospect in the cities.
Corporations have pushed life to such an edge that this can't go on.
So there you go, there's a little flavour about what it's like. It's really good. It is a very good film. So I had a little chat with them when they came to Brighton, and they had the screening of the film aided by the Brighton and Hove Food Partnership. And I had a chat with them in the garden. It was on a metal table, so occasionally you hear these odd clangs, so apologies for that. But I started out by asking them to tell me about why they wanted to make the film.
In realising, you know, the amount of toxic chemicals that are being used in agriculture and food production. And I was absolutely shocked. I thought that was something they did before, surely not anymore, whatever. So we started doing some research, and just felt like this was such a big story that people need to know about this. People need to be able to make informed choices about the food they buy and the consequences of that, not only to us and our health, but the environment, the farmer's economy, etc., etc. So that was sort of the origin of making the film.
And there's one huge thing that, for me, was finding out not only that it is toxic chemicals, but where did these toxic chemicals come from? That was the big thing for me that shocked me. It comes from war.
Yeah.
I didn't know this, and I thought, well, you know, I really think in terms of when we started making the film, and that should be the beginning of the film. Mm. Just start there, you know, and shock people, because I think people will be incredibly shocked to know this if they don't already know it. And I think actually a lot of people don't know.
Mm.
Because I didn't think about this until I started thinking about food and food growing and farming and agriculture and what is this and what are these pesticides and actually, by the way, where do they come from?
Mm.
And when we started to unravel all that, open it up and look at it, it was shocking. But it's not all gloom and doom.
Oh, good.
No. Well, there is a solution. There's a way out of this. There really is.
Hmm.
And it's all of us together choosing. You know, there's two systems in place here. There's the big, dominant 98% in the first world system of chemical food, chemically grown food, and then there's the small little, you know, ecological, organic farmers. Growing food, and actually in reality they are the people who are feeding most of the people in the world today. We in the first world just don't know this. They're feeding the rest of the third world,
which is most
of the people in the world. So it's true, we are feeding people. With the world is being fed by small ecological farmers.
There's two big lies actually in all of this. Like, number one is that the chemical companies, they say, like, you know, we need to feed a growing population. And they said that in the 60s, and they're saying it now with GM, same thing. We need to have this in order to feed a growing population. And the truth of the matter is, like, you know, the chemically grown food, they are not more efficient. They're better at marketing. They're more profitable. They have that whole bit, but they're actually not producing more food. That's just a lie, straight out. But most people buy it, you know, because that's what we're being told in their advertising. So that's a big sort of myth or lie that we're trying to sort of show in the film, too, that that's actually not the way it is. And we were really lucky we found archival footage from the 50s that shows what they were saying. So you can see, okay, that's what they said then, this is the reality, and this is where we're at now.
Back in 60s, I think, late 60s, they were talking about, oh, we need to feed a growing population. And now they're saying the same thing.
Mm.
And they're using genetically modified now. Before they were just using them straight up pesticides and fertilizers.
Is it the same people doing that?
There's six major chemical companies, which actually people will see in the film how they got to get so big.
Mm.
You know, how did that happen? Well, the film will tell you. But anyway, we had six major chemical companies: Dow, DuPont, Monsanto, BASF in Germany, Bayer, and Syngenta in Switzerland. That is, we are down to four now. Mm. Syngenta got bought out by ChemChina, so now they're a big player. ChemChina's in this now. Dow and DuPont have merged. Bayer bought Monsanto conveniently because Monsanto's name is now trash. And then you've got BASF still standing by itself.
Mm.
So you've had these big, big, big mergers. And I don't know if they've actually gone through 100%. They will.
Mm.
But that should let us know that we are in a world where they are massively centralizing the food system. And so that doesn't create food security.
Mm.
I guess the thing too with the chemicals, I mean, it's not just to maintain the profits that these companies do. It's actually the whole system of growing food using chemicals is kind of like a junkie. It's like the more you use of it, the more you need.
Mm.
The more artificial fertilizer you have, the weaker the plants get, the more susceptible to pests. You put on the pesticides, that makes the soil weaker, blah, blah, blah. So it's sort of not even maintaining profits. It's to make you more and more and more dependent on buying their products, to the point where GM, where it's like seeds that don't reproduce. You have to buy the seeds, to buy the fertilizer, you have to buy the pesticides.
Mm.
And then, you know, the good side to all of this is, of course, that the way to fight this is, of course, to do the opposite, is to save your own seed, grow your food as much as you can, support the small local growers and all of that. That's how we fight them.
It's just education, isn't it? I mean, you didn't know before you started making this film that this was even happening.
Exactly.
Well, I guess one actual sort of trigger, too, was that when we had moved to Australia, we realized that every year this helicopter came and flew all along the coast of eastern Australia spraying glyphosate Roundup all along the coast. And we're like, what's going on? So that was it. So we started this.
Helicopter.
Yeah.
Because it's easy. And the guy had a contract.
One guy had a contract. And the whole backstory to that was they were doing sand mining. When you do sand mining, you destabilize the dunes. Then they planted this beetle bush from South Africa there that spread enormously. So then now we need to spray that. So it's this cycle of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we found out about that and we started a group. We demonstrated. We stopped the spraying in the local little area.
Oh,
we started a chemical-free land care group to show we can do this without chemicals. And then actually a friend of us who's involved in pesticides and toxic issues in Australia, she said, if you think this is bad, look at agriculture.
Mm.
And we did. And so that's sort of part of the sort of, you know, how we got into
how
the film too.
It.
Yeah, no. I mean, you know, you look at cancer stats.
Mm.
Everything's going up. Mm. And yes, you know, it correlates. Things correlate. And Mariel Watts talks about that. There's a lot of correlation.
Yeah.
When they introduced the chemicals into the East, you know, Asia, she said, you know, you can't say, oh, no, this caused this, but you see correlations, you know.
Mm.
Pesticide use goes up, cancer rates go up.
Mm.
And, you know, we've got a really sad story, a sad, intense story that we start the film out with in India, with these, you know, cancer. There's a thing called the cancer train that leaves Bathinda in Punjab to Rajasthan, and a lot of the people on that train have cancer from working in the fields, from being in this environment where they're getting inundated with pesticides of all kinds. You know, I mean, Punjab is a tiny little state in India, and they use 18% of the pesticides used in India.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
It's a really sad tale, that one. But, you know, like I said, it starts out grim, and it is grim, you know, and I think it's important for us to look at this and go, well, yeah, okay, why do we have such growing cancer rates, you know? Yes, smoking's bad for us, and yes, you know, and alcohol and sitting and watching TV and not exercising and eating junk food. But, you know, the people in Punjab, they don't smoke or drink or any of that because they're Sikhs, you know, they don't do this. So how come they're getting cancer?
The thing with our film that we try to do differently, because, I mean, there's been films on GM and on, you know, farm
farm workers, different aspects. And what we try to do is to tie it all together. How is this all connected? And then come out with what can we do to change it? You know, we were really lucky. We got some really good activists like Vandana Shiva is in the film, Joel Salatin. That gives really sort of hands-on ideas of what we can do, you know, to change it. So that's sort of, that's the...
Yeah, because it's called The Worm is Turning.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's, yeah, it does say, it kind of evokes that there is some movement,
change.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
That's why we named it
that. And then basically all the solutions are kind of the opposite to the big centralized corporate system. It's small scale, it's organic, it's saving your own seeds, it's all biodiversity, huge thing in terms of food security. You know, if you just have one crop you grow and that fails, you're screwed, basically.
Yeah.
So we have a really beautiful story, some women in India who were, they used to work on a farm as laborer, and they got paid like a rupee or two a day if they got paid. And then that was in the 70s in India, and this is a really good idea that I think we should think about everywhere. It's like they had land reform. So they said, like, if you earn more than 50 hectares, you have to give half of it back to the state, and then the state distributes it to people that don't have land. Beautiful, right?
Mm.
So except that, of course, people gave away the least fertile land. So this group that we met with, they came in and they helped the women to make the land fertile. And it's all using just, you know, organic principles doing it. And they now, they grow a lot of different things. They feed themselves, they feed their communities, they have seed banks. They don't sell anything. They give you a kilo of seed and they say, if you can give us back a kilo, fine. If you can't, fine, because we just want you to be able to have as good life as we have. So, I mean, it's those kinds of stories that where you really go, okay, there are other ways. And in terms of food security, they grow in this area, it's very dry, and they grow mainly sorghum and millet, and they grow different strains. So they grow one that is really well when it rains a lot, one that is well in drought, and a couple in between. So no matter how the weather comes out, they're fine.
Mm.
And these women probably would be the part of the hungry, because you see the problem with hunger in the world is not that there's not enough food. There's actually enough food to feed 11 billion people. It's the marketplace that charges too much for them to be able to afford.
Where did this film take you? How many different countries? So you did obviously India and
we went to India, America. And within America, I think probably five states, and India probably five states.
You just followed the trail.
Yes.
Well,
we just went where people were willing to be interviewed.
I think when you do something like this, it's like you can't plan it all out beforehand, you know? So you sort of take a step, and then it sort of feels like the universe sort of aligns somehow and allow these things to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt like it sort of at one point almost that the story needed to be told. And and I guess I wanted to add on one thing too on the sort of empowerment side. I mean, the great thing about food is that, you know, all of us that are lucky enough to eat every day, we do have choices in what we eat. And that way, you know, who are and what are we supporting, you know? Mm. So in that is something we can take action like right away, as opposed to some issues maybe a little bit overwhelming like global warming, where do we start? But food is something that we can, you know.
Yeah, it's all is within our power, isn't it? It's where we spend our money. It's, you know, we're not asleep. We can wake up to these things.
Well, that is what we...
And that's what you're trying to do,
that's
is wake
exactly.
up.
We're trying to plant seeds to make people go, you know what, I don't want to support this system.
Yeah.
And that's why we put in the sort of heavy aspect of this, which is, you know, this comes from war, and it is war. It's the war that never ended, as you know, we say in the film, and as Vandana Shiva said, you know. I mean, she has this great line, you know, that we're eating World War II's leftovers.
That's a scary
How about that one?
Bon appetit.
Bon appetit, right, exactly.
That's Asa Mark and Hilary Bain. You can find out more about their film on thewormisturning.com. You can either arrange for them to come along and organise a screening, or you can just download the film or buy the film. It is really good. It covers so many interesting things, and you know, a lot of that stuff, a lot of those topics I have talked about previously on this show, and it is just all around reclaiming our land, I think, and being able to farm it in a way that is healthy and appropriate for us. I love that bit in there about the land reform idea in India, where if anyone owned more than a certain amount, they had to reappropriate that land. And they, although they did give away the least fertile land, it still shared out the land. I mean, what a brilliant idea. So yes, find them on wormisturning.com. Okay, we're going to have a song, and it's Bob Dylan and Times They Are A-Changing.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. And if your breath to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
That was Bob Dylan and Times They Are A-Changing. Okay, we're coming to the end of the show. I want to say how grateful I am to people like Asa, like Hillary, like Marion, who, like Chris, who dedicate so much of their lives to trying to make things better for all of us and raise awareness and try and fight these bigger companies whose interests do not lie with the earth and do not lie with us. I feel quite privileged to speak to these people, and I'm in awe of them, really. You know, us humans are a funny lot, really. I think some of us will always perhaps see the land as a resource and something to be mined for money, and that we can own it, and it's somehow its whole existence is there for us. And then there's others who see that we're just stewards, and there's a partnership to be had and a duty of care. So, you know, we gain so much from it, and we have to just be really aware. And I know that is heavily biased, and other people have different viewpoints, but when I speak to people like the people that have been on the show, you know, it highlights it more and more for me. So do check out their work. All of the links are on the Growing Wild show page on radioreverb.com. This show is sponsored by Infinity Foods, and I am Charlotte Petz. Thank you very much for listening. You can get me on Instagram and Twitter on @growingwildfm. Email is growingwildreverb@gmail.com. I'll be back next month talking about plastics. Woohoo! I'm going to play you out with Harry Belafonte and Give Us Our Land. Take care and go well. La tatouage.